Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026, and this is our cybersecurity edition.
Today, we are examining the erosion of the traditional perimeter as the primary unit of defense. We are moving away from static, boundary-based security toward a landscape defined by autonomous adaptive threats that operate at machine speed.
It is no longer about holding the line, but managing the breach.
Precisely.
To understand this shift, we must first look at the agentic arms race and the urgent need to secure the new AI frontier. Over 21,000 unique domains were recently exposed because a single vulnerability in Microsoft Copilot allowed credentials to leak through URL parameters during the agent's processing phase. We are talking about a massive automated exposure that could hit up to 20,000 different companies in a single stroke. Today, we're looking at the agentic arms race, the cybersecurity implications of a world where AI isn't just answering questions, but acting on our behalf.
It is a fundamental shift in the attack surface because we are moving from human-scale prompting, which is isolated and predictable, to agentic-scale workflows. These agents can autonomously research, connect, and ground business data across third-party models, creating a continuous automated barrage of requests that look nothing like traditional web traffic.
So we've gone from a single person asking a chatbot for a summary to a swarm of autonomous bots poking at every corner of the enterprise. It sounds like a nightmare for anyone trying to maintain a perimeter.
It's actually a breakdown of the perimeter itself. As Application Security Weekly noted, agents represent a new, unstable class of identity because they break the fundamental security dichotomy between slow, smart human and fast, dumb machine identities. Traditional service accounts are predictable and static, but agents are numerous and non-deterministic. They behave like humans but move at machine speed.
Which sounds like a fancy way of saying, we've just invited a group of unpredictable, high-speed interns into the server room and given them the keys to the kingdom.
The pattern is clear. The danger isn't just that they might be malicious. Neha Duggal has pointed out that the primary risk is actually naive agents. These are agents that aren't trying to hack you, but they have overprivileged, standing access, and they execute a command, like dropping a database, simply because they are aggressively trying to fulfill a program task.
So it's not a heist, it's an accidental demolition derby.
And this is why the proliferation of these agents is threatening to collapse role-based access control, or RBAC. Application Security Weekly argues that since modern enterprises already possess more roles than employees, a 10 times increase in agents will make traditional role management mathematically and operationally impossible. You simply cannot manage a nonlinear explosion of identities using a linear management system.
Which leads us to the shadow AI problem. I'm assuming this isn't just employees using ChatGPT to write emails, but something much more invisible.
It's much deeper. Ankita Gupta defines shadow AI as unauthorized assets like LLMs and model context protocols, or MCPs, that bypass IT visibility entirely. We are seeing the emergence of shadow agent environments, where agents access undocumented sensitive data or use unauthorized tool calls. It's a new, non-standardized attack surface that lacks the predictable web-based footprint of traditional shadow IT.
And I imagine the tools we use to catch these shadows are also running on AI.
That's the recursive loop. Enterprise Security Weekly warns of an AI teaching AI feedback loop, where security professionals increasingly rely on the very LLMs they are attempting to secure to write the policies and guardrails meant to govern them. If the teacher is compromised or hallucinating, the student's security policy is DOA.
It's a hall of mirrors. But let's talk about the actual mechanics of the arms race. If an attacker can't just brute force a password, how are they actually getting in?
They are exploiting the thinking phase and the trust models of the agents themselves. Take the AutoJack vulnerability in Microsoft's AutoGen Studio, which allows malicious web content to exploit WebSocket and authentication flaws to achieve remote command execution via an agent. Or look at the Model Context Protocol. Smashing Security reported that MCP creates a high-trust attack vector where coding agents treat data from external services, like Sentry error logs, as authoritative. An attacker can plant malicious instructions within a legitimate-looking error report, and the agent just executes it.
They aren't breaking the door down, they're just slipping a note under the door that says, "Hey, the building is on fire, please open the safe."
That is exactly what the SearchLeak vulnerability does. Cybersecurity Headlines described it as a courier mechanism. It uses prompt injection to bypass security checks and exfiltrates data through legitimate services like Bing. The attacker isn't hacking the system, they are manipulating the legitimate, automated processes of the service itself to deliver data to them under the guise of a standard request.
It's incredibly clever, but also deeply unsettling. It feels like we're moving toward a world where vibe coding, as some are calling it, replaces rigorous engineering.
And that's a massive risk. James Wilson has warned that vibe coding is driving a new class of bugs because developers are increasingly abandoning traditional, rigorous code reviews in favor of trusting agent outputs. We're seeing the emergence of authorized attack chains where no malware is needed, just the exploitation of the inherent trust an agent has in its integrated tools to trigger unauthorized code execution on a developer's machine.
So the fix isn't just better firewalls. We have to change how we define identity altogether.
We have to move toward a zero-standing privileges model. We can't give agents long-lived credentials. We need to shift from attaching privileges to exploding groups to attaching identities directly to specific units of work. As Application Security Weekly suggests, we need to move toward attribute-based access control, or ABAC, where permissions are ephemeral and tied to a specific just-in-time request, like a single deployment ticket, and then they simply evaporate once the task is done.
Essentially, we need to treat every AI agent like a temporary contractor who only gets a keycard for one specific room, for one specific hour, and only if they can prove they actually have a meeting scheduled there.
And ideally, that identity should be rooted in something we can't spoof, like hardware-bound microchips, rather than just a piece of transferable data that can be leaked or sold.
It's an exhausting cycle. We're building faster machines to defend against even faster machines, and the goalposts are moving every 6 months.
The CISO's dilemma is real. We are facing a six-month dilemma where we cannot predict technological or operational shifts beyond a very short horizon. The entire cyber ecosystem's timeline is being compressed.
Security architects need to stop building fortresses and start building adaptive, automated immune systems. Keep an eye on the rise of agentic control frameworks. If we see the industry move toward using high-quality models solely to audit and orchestrate cheaper, commodity models, it will signal that the era of unmanaged autonomy is officially over. But as these machines start making their own decisions, how do we even begin to regulate the humans behind the code? $700 million. That is the scale of the proposed budget cut facing CISA, the United States' primary shield against cyber warfare. We are looking at a fundamental dismantling of our national digital defense, and it's happening right under our noses while the headlines are focused elsewhere.
It's more than just a budget line item, Maya. We're seeing a massive structural hollowout of the agency. Senator Mark Warner has been sounding the alarm, noting that CISA has already lost approximately 1/3 of its workforce. This isn't just about raw headcount either. The recent cuts specifically targeted senior-level personnel, meaning the agency is losing its institutional memory.
It's like a high-end restaurant that decides to save money by firing all the head chefs and replacing them with unpaid interns who have never seen a stove. You might still have a kitchen, but you're essentially just waiting for a fire to start.
To that point, the instability is systemic. CISA hasn't had a permanent director since January 2025, and half of its regional directors are currently just acting placeholders. On the record, analysts noted that this isn't just a leadership vacuum, it's a fiscal carving up of the agency. Former DHS Secretary Kristi Noem's decision to cease MSISAC funding, combined with direct budget reductions, is creating a massive defensive gap for state and local governments who rely on that federal support.
And the silver lining. Acting Director Nick Anderson is claiming a massive expansion via 300 new hires.
But that expansion is being undermined by the math. If the FY2027 budget faces a $700 million reduction, you end up with a massive mismatch between new personnel and the actual operational funding available to them. It's an expansion of capacity without the fuel to run the engine.
It feels like we're being asked to defend a fortress while the government is simultaneously selling off the gate guards and the castle walls. And it's not just the US. We're seeing the shift toward automated high-speed warfare.
The new CISA binding operational directives now require federal agencies to prioritize patching vulnerabilities that can be easily automated through AI. The logic is a clear causal chain. AI-driven attacks significantly shorten the window for exploitation, which necessitates a new automated decision tree for defense. But there's a geopolitical second-order risk here. The U.S. Commerce Department's imposition of export controls on Anthropic models could actually prevent international defenders from using these advanced models to secure their own networks, effectively disarming them.
So the U.S. is essentially saying we have the best shields, but we're going to make sure you can't use them to protect yourself.
It creates a massive asymmetry. And it's not just about the tech, it's about the regulatory gaps. The record from Recorded Future News highlighted that the EU's export control regime is struggling with a fundamental enforcement gap. The European Commission has the legal framework, but they lack the jurisdictional authority to stop member states from essentially rubber stamping licenses. You could see a situation where a country like Bulgaria authorizes a sale to a repressive regime, and the Central Commission is legally sidelined.
It's the don't ask, don't tell of international arms control. Meanwhile, the people actually running the front lines, the CISOs, are caught in a different kind of squeeze. The talent market is getting weird.
It's a structural shift in the labor market. There is a growing trend where companies are preferring to hire first-time CISOs at a significant discount rather than paying for seasoned veterans. This is effectively devaluing experienced talent and creating a saturated pool of qualified candidates who are now moving into consulting or field roles.
Instead of hiring the person who has survived a breach, companies are hiring the person who has only ever read the manual because they're cheaper.
It's a dangerous trade-off, especially as the nature of the threat is changing. The rise of agentic AI represents a structural break in security. We are moving from managing technical debt to managing an existential, scalable vulnerability discovery process that simply exceeds human patching capabilities. This is why, as CyberWire Daily points out, the traditional paradigm of prevention and detection is hitting diminishing returns. You can spend infinite amounts on those areas, but they cannot stop a single successful breach. The focus has to shift toward what they call the return on resilience, measuring the quantifiable financial value of an organization's ability to maintain service delivery during an inevitable event.
Which brings us back to the boardroom. I keep hearing that CISOs need to stop talking about patch rates and start talking about the economics of downtime.
We can trace that further. If you present technical KPIs like vulnerability counts, you lose the board. You have to translate security posture into the specific dollar impact on revenue and the cost of operational disruption. If you can't tie a breach to a loss in EBITDA, the board won't prioritize the budget.
It's a brutal pivot from engineering to economics.
And there's a hidden risk in the insurance market too. Enterprise Security Weekly noted that cyber insurance claims latency is creating a dead zone for small and medium businesses. Even with coverage, the potential for decade-long payout delays means a company could collapse from cash flow exhaustion before the insurance company ever cuts a check.
State-level governors need to start auditing their reliance on federal CISA grants immediately.
Watch for the first major regional infrastructure failure in a U.S. state that follows the MSISAC funding withdrawal. That will be the proof of the vacuum.
But the rot in our digital defenses might be even deeper than policy failures. It's moving into the very building blocks of our software.
I've been looking through the recent incident reports, and there is a terrifyingly clear pattern emerging in how the very foundations of our software are being turned into weapons.
You say pattern, but it sounds more like a slow-motion train wreck in the developer ecosystem. What are we looking at?
It's a transition from targeting specific applications to a full-scale siege of the infrastructure itself. We're seeing a move from simple malicious packages to deep, structural compromises of the tools developers use every single day.
Instead of trying to pick the lock on the front door, they're just poisoning the water supply before it even reaches the house.
It's a telling detail. Take the North Korean group Sapphire Sleet. They didn't just launch a random attack. They compromised the Mastra AI framework by hijacking the eHindero maintainer account, which allowed them to inject malware into over 140 NPM packages. This isn't just a bug, it's a direct pipeline into developer machines to steal high-value API keys and credentials.
Poisoning the water supply is a bit dramatic, isn't it? They're essentially just squatting in the pipes.
It's more invasive than squatting. They're using what the SAN Stormcast calls lifecycle hooks. In the Arch Linux AUR crisis, we saw attackers using NPM's pre-install feature to execute malicious binaries. The JavaScript code itself looks perfectly clean to a static scanner, but the moment you run the install command, a hidden process triggers to steal your SSH keys and Docker credentials.
So the code looks fine, but the installation process is actually a digital Trojan horse.
Worth noting, the industry is trying to patch this, but it's creating a massive friction point. NPM is moving toward a deny-by-default approach for install scripts, but as we've seen, that threatens to break critical high-traffic packages like ESBuild and Sharp. It's a choice between a broken workflow and a compromised one.
Which I assume is exactly what the attackers are banking on, that will choose broken over difficult.
That's the reality. And it's not just package managers. The record from Recorded Future News reports that the Shai-Hulud supply chain worm is exploiting a massive blind spot in GitHub's own indexing. The payload is about 4.6 megabytes, just large enough to exceed the threshold for GitHub's code search. This allows the worm to hide in plain sight, impacting major entities like the European Commission and Red Hat.
Wait, so they're hiding in the unsearchable parts of the code? That's not even a hack, that's just clever filing.
It's even more sophisticated than that. The researchers found that these actors are using temporal camouflage. They manipulate client-supplied commit timestamps and unmanaged author metadata so that a malicious injection looks like a routine historical edit from a trusted engineer. They are weaponizing the very design features of Git to make an attack look like a legacy update.
If you see a piece of code from 3 years ago, you can't actually trust that it wasn't actually planted yesterday.
You can't. And the downstream impact is cascading. Cybersecurity Headlines pointed out how the Icarus Extortion Group used the Clue breach to target multiple security firms at once. By compromising a single set of OAuth tokens, they could programmatically extract massive volumes of CRM data from third-party services like Salesforce. One compromised integration becomes a gateway to an entire ecosystem of connected business data.
It's a domino effect, but the dominoes are all connected by invisible, highly privileged strings.
That's the perfect way to put it. We're even seeing it in the IDEs. There's a new class of attacks targeting JetBrains plugins. These modified, legitimate-looking plugins are designed to intercept user input, specifically when you click an apply button, to exfiltrate AI API keys via ClearText HTTP to raw IP addresses, specifically avoiding hostnames to bypass domain-based detection.
So even the apply button in your editor is now a potential exfiltration trigger.
Every click is a risk. Even the way we handle technical interviews is changing. Johannes Ulrich noted a trend where attackers use malicious job interviews, sending developers highly personalized, poisoned technical assessments to get them to run untrusted code on their primary workstations.
I suppose the only way to survive is to treat every new piece of code like a biohazard.
We're seeing the start of that. The Athena Coalition is a new structural shift where competitors like JPMorgan Chase and Cisco are actually pooling remediation data to secure shared open source dependencies. It's a move from reactive siloed patching to a coordinated industry response.
Because at this point, the perimeter is basically just an illusion.
It's more than an illusion, it's a vanishing point. Even the security controls in NPM might just be a measurement artifact. We might see fewer malware hits on the registry dashboard, but that doesn't mean the threat is gone. It just means the attacks have migrated to unmonitored surfaces like shell scripts or CDNs.
Security teams need to stop celebrating clean dashboards and start looking at the shadows.
Exactly.
Developers and security architects need to move all third-party code execution into isolated, ephemeral environments immediately. Watch for any sudden surge in maintenance updates for widely used build tools, because that's where the next layer of the siege will likely be hidden. But if the very tools we use to build the future are being compromised, how much can we trust the players behind the curtain of global intelligence? We like to imagine cybersecurity as a high-stakes game of digital cat and mouse, but lately it feels more like a slow-motion collision between too much larger, much more violent forces. Alex, if you had to bet, are we looking at an era of smarter defenses, or just a more efficient way for nations to prepare for a real-world fight?
The data suggests the latter, because the very definition of the battlefield is shifting toward what NCSC CEO Richard Horn calls intelligence-encoded kinetic warfare. We aren't just seeing data theft anymore. We're seeing state actors like China's Volt Typhoon using cyber incursions to establish dormant footholds in critical infrastructure, creating a prepositioning effect where they can trigger mass physical disruption during a future actual conflict.
It's not a heist, it's just someone installing a bomb and waiting for the right moment to press the button.
Something to flag here, this isn't just theoretical. NCSC's recent reporting shows that 75% of attacks on British critical national infrastructure are now attributed to hostile state actors. The distinction between peace and war in cyberspace is essentially collapsing, because the high-frequency interception of these breaches shows we're likely already in the opening exchanges of a much larger conflict.
It's almost impressively patient. I mean, I struggle to cancel a subscription without checking my bank statement, yet these groups are just lurking.
The patience is the most dangerous part of the mechanism. Cybersecurity Headlines reported that the group UNC6508 has been targeting roughly 8,500 internet-exposed RedCap clinical research servers, and they've maintained undetected access to some of them for a full year before ever deploying a payload. This creates a massive, unmonitored attack surface because over 99% of these globally exposed medical research servers are running outdated, vulnerable software. This patching gap allows for extreme dwell times where the adversary harvests credentials and maps the network long before any visible damage occurs.
The medical research sector is basically a digital waiting room for state-sponsored actors.
It is, and it's part of a broader strategic shift where small nations can now bypass expensive military assets like aircraft carriers by using low-cost cyber operations to threaten a society's very foundation. We're even seeing it in the radio spectrum. CyberWire Daily noted that Russia may be using signal leakage, the accidental overflow from high-bandwidth wartime communications into adjacent GPS frequencies, as a dual-use strategy to test signal integrity while simultaneously conducting subtle intermittent jamming.
It's a very efficient way to turn the entire electromagnetic spectrum into a playground for interference.
It's a move away from traditional IT-centric hacking toward a model of continuous contest. Even the way we handle intelligence is changing. The record from Recorded Future News highlighted how the relationship between the EU and Ukraine is transitioning into a reciprocal intelligence ecosystem, where Ukraine's frontline experience with Russian hacking provides the EU with real-time data to strengthen its collective defense through the EU Cybersecurity Reserve.
It's a grim cycle. More frontline experience leads to better data, which leads to more sophisticated, more persistent state-sponsored presence in our networks.
And the risk management model is breaking. We can't just manage these threats anymore because the strategic goal for these states is to avoid establishing red lines that would limit their own future offensive freedom of movement. They want to stay just below the threshold of an act of war while ensuring their access remains permanent.
Infrastructure owners need to stop treating these breaches as isolated IT incidents and start auditing for long-term persistent presence. Keep an eye on the July publication of the National Cyber Action Plan to see if it actually addresses this pre-positioning threat or just offers more of the same. But this level of deep-seated access isn't just threatening the power grid, it's also creating a massive-scale disruption in how global industries handle their own private data. If you want to see how truly fragile the global supply chain is, just look at a single sugar mill in Queensland. We're far past simple data theft. We are entering an era where ransomware is essentially just a tool for industrial sabotage.
It's more than just sabotage, Maya. It's a highly optimized business model. As Enterprise Security Weekly noted, threat actors are using criminal actuarial science to target sectors where the ROI on disruption is highest. Take the recent attack on Mackay Sugar in Australia. By hitting the racecourse in Farley Mills, the Gentleman Ransomware Group didn't just lock files. They halted harvesting during a critical window, threatening a $420 million revenue stream that feeds markets in Japan and South Korea.
So it's a domino effect. A hijacked WordPress site for a local restaurant leads to a broken auto shop, which eventually leads to a shortage of refined sugar in a Tokyo supermarket.
Two things stand out, and the infrastructure for that domino effect is often already in place. The recent international law enforcement operation against the SOC Galish botnet, involving the FBI and Dutch National High-Tech Crime Unit, revealed how attackers hijack low-security, trusted websites like those local restaurants to serve as a gateway for much larger groups like Lockbit and RansomHub.
It's essentially infrastructure as a service for criminals.
Stepping back, the Gentleman Group is even centralizing the technical heavy lifting. Cybersecurity Headlines reported that their Gentle Killer Toolkit allows affiliates to use driver exploits to shut down over 400 security processes, effectively stripping away EDR protections. We're seeing this sophistication move into the financial sector too. Dave Bittner and Tom Kellerman discussed how the Shadow Water 63 cartel used banana rat malware to target 16 Brazilian financial institutions and crypto exchanges.
It's getting harder to hide from the damage.
It is.
New strains like Prinz Eugen are even becoming forensic aware, specifically targeting recently modified files so that even your most recent backups are rendered useless.
Supply chain managers need to audit their secondary vendors' backup integrity, not just their own. Watch for any spike in shocking stock manipulation patterns following large-scale data leaks. As we wrap up this edition, the thread connecting everything we've discussed today is the total erosion of the boundary between trusted infrastructure and malicious intent. Whether it is the structural compromise of development pipelines or the weaponization of autonomous agents, the very tools we use to build and automate our world are being repurposed to dismantle it from within.
That erosion is forcing a fundamental change in how leadership must allocate resources. The most critical shift we're seeing is in the calculus of national regulators and CISA leadership. With the massive reduction in CISA's workforce and budget, the responsibility for maintaining stability is being pushed back onto the private sector and critical infrastructure operators. We can no longer rely on a centralized federal safety net to catch breaches. Organizations must now move away from expecting perimeter defense and instead pivot toward an architecture that assumes the very tools they use, like Copilot or automated deployment scripts, are already compromised.
It's no longer about preventing an intrusion, but about ensuring an intrusion cannot become an irreversible catastrophe.
The data tells a story to see if this new decentralized reality is truly taking hold. Keep a close eye on the upcoming regulatory frameworks coming out of the EU Commission regarding the auditing of autonomous agents. If we see them move toward mandatory high-friction verification for every automated software identity, it will confirm that the industry is finally acknowledging that we can no longer trust the speed of innovation without a tether.
Thanks for joining us for this week's Cybersecurity Digest. We'll be back next Tuesday.